12 weeks for £12. Subscribe to The Spectator for this excellent deal and get a £20 Amazon voucher at www.spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Kate Andrews and James Forsyth. Today we have an announcement from the government, and it's not about a second wave, it's not about a local lockdown, it is about planning. Kate, this is something the government wants to talk about, so can you give us the details of what Robert Jenrick has been announcing today?
They do. They're proud of the fact that this is considered to be one of the largest shakeups to the planning structure in roughly 70 years. And the idea is to move to a more clear-cut system in which planning applications, if they meet certain requirements, should be presumed that they're going ahead. Previously, every planning application has been treated as bespoke. It can be extremely hard to get them through. The idea here is that it's more of a rules-based system, almost a checklist, if you will. And if you meet pre-approved design codes, which are going to be coming in, and also if you want to build in development zones, which are coming in, then the idea is that you should be going ahead. You should presume that your development is able to go ahead. And there are many aspects here that are thought to empower local communities. Councils are going to be given up to 3.5 years, I believe, to designate which areas they want to build more, which areas they want to preserve. And it's also thought that local residents will get some kind of say in what these developments look like and the design around them. They want their local communities to feel excited and eager about these new developments coming in, not resentful. But of course, there is some pushback today, especially from those what many would deem NIMBYs not in my backyard, who are very nervous about what new developments in their area might mean. I think from the more free market side, there's also some disappointment there that they haven't really touched the green belt. It's thought that at least in England, up to a third of the green belt is really not very nice land at all, and that you could use this land, particularly around city centers and major metropolitan areas, to build more, to bring the cost of homes down. So there are frustrations on both sides today, but the government's excited about it because it's a shakeup that they think is going to lead to more homes being built, and that's key for getting more people onto the housing ladder.
James, Kate mentions the NIMBYs. There's long been a divide in the Tory party between those who talk about planning reform, some who talk about it but then don't like it when it happens, and some who just don't like talking about it. So how does the party split? Is this something there is going to be a vote on? And also just in terms of, has the party changed in how it looks at housing?
So I think that the sensitivities of the Tory backbenchers are why the Greenbelt has been so conspicuously left alone. I mean, they're not even doing the kind of mile Greenbelt stuff that you could do. Say, well, within a mile of a station you can build, for example. You know, that was always a Philip Hammond idea. They're not even going there. I think they have no choice but to see this through, because this is the most significant supply-side reform the government has come up with. And there simply isn't enough money to do all the stimulating of the economy that will need to be done post-coronavirus through tax cuts or spending increases. So you have to have some supply-side reform. And this is really the only substantial supply-side reform that the government have. Now, I can already hear you saying, Katie, well, look, you know, Sunday trading, that's minor in comparison to this, and they backed right off that as soon as they started getting letters from Tory backbenchers. I think in a way the difference here is that this is actually does offer, if you can get it through, some far more significant economic gain than Sunday trading did. And I think if they don't do this, then they really would have no supply side agenda at all.
There have been warnings today, Kate, in certain quarters that this could lead to slums in the UK. I think The Guardian carries quite a lot of criticism from various housing groups and a suggestion that actually by cutting red tape, you'd be cutting standards and making it harder for social housing. What's behind that, and what issue do they have with what's being announced today?
Well, this is the classic argument that if you cut red tape, you're going to lead to lower standards. That's sort of the basic argument if you don't want to see that red tape cut. I think the difference here is that it isn't as if developers aren't going to have to meet very specific requirements to be able to build. It's that they're going to be laid out ahead of time. What often happens is you, as a developer, go to try to get your planning permissions, and your application, because of pushback in the local community, is just put through the ringer, and they try to find anything they they can to stop that development from going ahead. Now they're saying, if you can meet our standards, which we're laying out and making very clear on the design side and on the location side, then we want to give you confidence that you're going to be able to go ahead. You should be able to presume that unless there's something really outrageous or outlandish about your application, that it will be able to go ahead. And I find these accusations about slums quite baffling. I mean, if you believe in social mobility, if you believe in tackling intergenerational unfairness, if you believe in bringing people out of poverty, then you know in the UK especially, we need to build more homes. And I think opposition to that, simply because you don't like the idea of red tape not just being slashed but just changing, is a bit absurd.
Now, in order for us to have podcasts like today's where we lead on an issue that isn't coronavirus, we need test and trace to be working. But there have been figures today which show actually there's been a small fall, in test and trace contacts reached. So the latest figures for England show that 72.4% of close contacts of people who have tested positive for coronavirus were reached, down from 76.2% the previous week. Now, that is very minor, but we also have a piece in this week's Spectator looking at the fact that as things stand, it does seem as though lots of people are not being reached to begin with. James, what is the sense in government in terms of how successful test and trace is being here?
I think there's a lot of frustration about test and trace in government. I think there's a lot of frustration that the data isn't specific enough, and that's why you end up having to lock down the whole of Greater Manchester rather than being able to isolate the areas that are a specific problem. So the piece in Spectator this week says that for every one person who is isolating, there are 20 people out there potentially spreading the infection. And that statistic sounds awful and is obviously problematic, but I was very struck by Imperial Ipsos Mori work, which basically suggests that about 80% of people who have the virus don't know that they have it. Now, I struggle to see how test and trace can work with that, because why would you go and get tested if you don't have any symptoms? And I think that yet again makes the case for mass testing as the best strategy. You know, we see a bit of these tests that rolled out in 90 minutes. I mean, every workplace should get a bucket and everyone should spit in the bucket every day. And this is the way that we are going to get on top of this virus. I think a virus where 80% of people don't realize they have it, I don't see how a system that doesn't use mass testing is going to work, because by definition, that 80% of people are not going to go out and get tested. You could have, you know, the best system of contact tracing, which we clearly don't, but you could genuinely have a world-beating system of contact tracing, and I don't see how it would work in a situation where 80% of people don't have them. So yeah, so get a bucket, spit in it, and let's make some progress.
Kate, do you support the spitting bucket strategy?
The Forsyth spitting bucket coming to the Spectator soon. Look, I think it's extremely worrying that
we haven't quite got an answer on that.
The ONS. I think it's extremely worrying that the ONS statistics, which are basically randomly sampling parts of the UK, are thought to be more reliable than what's actually coming out of the test and trace system. And it goes yet again, I mean, I feel like a broken record here, but how can you not talk about the app that is supposed to be online that isn't expected until autumn? As James says, if the vast majority of people who are infected with COVID-19 are walking around without symptoms, how would they know that they could potentially be passing it on, or that they might have the virus because they've been in contact with someone who has COVID-19, if they don't have an app that has alerted them to the fact that they've been in contact with that person? So if I get it from you, Katie, and I'm asymptomatic, but I find out that you had it, I can at least take action on that and get myself tested. So we just don't have the structure in place right now to be able to get really good data on this. And I think it's worrying that it seems as the current test and trace system with actual contact tracers is put under any pressure, doesn't really seem to be rising to the occasion. They're contacting fewer people than they were last week.
And I think if you want an example of how far behind on the tech curve we are on this, in Shanghai, when you get on the metro there, you scan a QR code in your carriage. And that means that, you know, if someone in your carriage comes down with the virus, tests positive for it, you are alerted. But the benefit of scanning that particular carriage means that you don't have to say to everyone, oh, everyone on this train, someone has it, or everyone who was in the station at this time. You really can isolate the people who might potentially have been in contact with you. And I think that's one of the big challenges. We've got to find some way of doing this. Given the app problems, I really don't see a better answer than mass testing.
And finally, on the issue of the app, James, we have heard that although we're not expecting a contact tracing app, we may get an app.
I think the app is more going to be kind of telling you, Katie, that you are a young person, a woman with a very normal BMI, and so therefore you're not at any particular risk. So it's an app, but kind of an app more with kind of coronavirus kind of information rather than a kind of contact tracing app.
They're going to launch an app that doesn't trace the virus.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Kate. Kate has a face of horror, but we're not going to go to her to get an explanation of it. And thank you for listening.
£12 for £12. Subscribe to The Spectator for this excellent deal and get a £20 Amazon voucher at www.spectator.co.uk/voucher.